and welcome to the Emotional Autoimmunity Podcast. I'm your host, Kerry Jeffrey. This podcast is all about having conversations about real life with chronic illness, bringing you interviews, information, and inspiration to help you live your best life with chronic illness. Hello and welcome everyone to episode 10 of the Emotional Autoimmunity Podcast. And today I'm absolutely delighted to have Sue Holly joining me today. And Sue is a legal assistant originally from New York City, which is a place I've always wanted to visit, Sue, so I'm a bit jealous about that. And she's now living in Seattle, Washington. Sue has been living with Hashimoto's thyroiditis for over 30 years, and more recently with pulmonary sarcoidosis, which likely went undiagnosed for over a decade before doing enough damage to her lungs that she requires supplementary oxygen. Being told that she had most likely a terminal illness with no treatment options except for a double lung transplant, Sue now hopes to prove the doctors wrong and to live the best quality of life that she can, no matter how long that may be. So welcome, Sue. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And I can only imagine what it must have been like for you to, you know, be given that diagnosis and such a negative potential outcome for you. How did you even start to deal with that and process that?
I think in the beginning, I was more angry at the previous doctors who had missed so many things that are very clear in retrospect. And you don't even know how to process something like that. I was 55 years old, and being told I might not make it to 60 is not something that's usually in a person's game plan. And here I'm thinking I've got decades ahead of me and then wondering what's going to happen. It's very frightening.
No, as I said, I just can't imagine. And do you feel that you'd been, you know, successfully integrated the Hashimoto's into your life? I mean, you've been living with that for decades. Did you feel that you were on top of that and you were managing all of that, and then suddenly this sarcoidosis diagnosis has come along?
Well, you know, getting the diagnosis of Hashimoto's was, like most people, an ordeal to begin with, which took many, many years. And no one really ever explained to me what autoimmune disease was, you know, or what kind of impact that could be. It was just, you know, take this pill and you'll be fine. And many of my symptoms were better, but I never felt 100% right, no matter what I did. And I just learned to ignore it because it was clear no one was really going to help me and there was nothing I could do at the time. So, you know, and I have a lot of mobility issues too from chronic pain. And so it just felt like my quality of life had been getting worse and worse over the years. So this was just the icing on top of the cake.
Yeah, that must have been really, really difficult. And we were talking before we started the recording and you were telling me that it's sort of looking back now, you can see the signs of the sarcoidosis that you're dealing with now and all of those years that never get picked up. So could you just tell people a little bit about that in hindsight, what you can see?
Well, sarcoidosis itself, it's an inflammatory disease where it mostly affects the lymph nodes and lungs, but it can affect all different systems of the body. And it grows almost like tumors, it's not cancer, but it grows like that and does havoc to whatever system it decides to live in. And it can go into remission, it can get worse, and people have varying experiences with it. And back about 25 years ago, I had nodules in my thyroid, which is how I finally got the Hashimoto's diagnosis. But I'm looking now and said that was inflammatory growths in my thyroid that then disappeared. And I've had mystery growths in my lymph nodes and in my knees, actually, where I have very bad joint damage. And it makes me wonder how much of that was sarcoidosis being, you know, moving around my body and just causing problems that people didn't really understand how to put together, since it is a rather rare syndrome. So it's not something that your average doctor has heard of, let alone knows what to do with.
And that makes everything so much harder, doesn't it? And so did they, apart from the double lung transplant, which, I mean, that's huge surgery, and I imagine there'd be a massive waiting list, and then you've got to be on all the immunosuppressant drugs, and, you know, it brings a whole host of problems with it. Were they, you know, at least trying to give you some hope, or did you find they really sort of just left you to just get on and deal with it as best you could?
Pretty much to just get on with it, and, you know, nothing we can really do for you. There are some, well, let me step back. The pulmonary sarcoidosis has caused scarring in my lungs, which is why I'm now on oxygen. And it also caused pulmonary hypertension, which is high blood pressure between the heart and the lungs. So when I'm in motion and when my heart rate goes up, my oxygen drops. So that has done some damage there. And then there's pulmonary fibrosis, which is the scarring in my lungs. So each one of those three things is considered a terminal illness. And the transplant was the only cure. And there are some medications they can give you that cost tens of thousands of dollars a month that might help, but mostly I think they don't. They just maybe put the symptoms off for a little bit. So, and then even in terms of the transplant, because I am over the weight limit to even get on the list at my center, that's not even an option, even if I was choosing it at this time.
And what was going on in your life at that time? I mean, what, you were still living in Washington, were you, and doing the job that you're doing now?
Yeah, I got divorced about 5 years before that. And so here I was trying to rebuild my life and thinking, okay, I'm going to take life by the storm and everything's going to be great. And then to have this just fall in my lap, it just seemed very unfair. And, you know, the oxygen, actually, I think I was more upset about that than anything else they were telling me, because we talked about this when I was doing sessions with you about, you know, in this society, when you see people on oxygen, I mean, we don't usually see it in public. Most people, when you see it, it's on a television program or in a movie, and it's usually someone who's very, very sick and they're dying and they're in a hospital. So when someone tells you suddenly that you need to be on oxygen 24/7, I mean, not only is that life-changing in itself, that was a death sentence. I was told at the time I had a flight planned for a vacation that I had to cancel, and they didn't know if I would be able to fly again. And I live 3,000 miles from my family, and the thought of never being able to see them again was, you know, I think I focus more on that than I did on even the prognosis of what they were telling me.
So life as you know it is over, and you've got this thing, and it's just going to get worse, and the oxygen is the start of it. And for, I mean, people will see, when I put the posts up about this, they'll see the lovely picture that you've sent in. And you're right, for most people, they see that somebody on oxygen, either they're in a bed or they're dying or they've been in some sort of terrible accident. And, you know, you have the little thing around your face and it just goes into your nose. And I know from the discussions that we've had together that you do fantastically well with how you changed your attitude towards the oxygen and how you've incorporated into your life. So could you just let people know, like, how did you go through that process of transforming something that felt like such a negative and such a scary thing to something that is just matter of fact and it's part of your life, and you're actually out there setting this really positive model for people?
Well, it was a little bit of a circuitous path to get there, because after these diagnoses, I spent 6 months being tortured with diagnostic tests and surgeries. Where they were doing scopes under general anesthesia. They did open surgery to take samples. You name it, they did it to me. And then they come up with all these diagnoses. So it was a very difficult path just to get there. And then to just have everything in my life turned upside down, I went into this very deep despair of hopelessness. And I was eating whatever I felt like eating and making jokes. I was very irreverent about, well, I'm dying anyway. So maybe if I eat this, it'll kill me. And then I don't have to die some horrible death of not breathing. And, you know, I was having almost fun with it, how irreverent I was, not realizing how upsetting this was to people who loved me, to hear me making these jokes. But this is how I was dealing with it. But I really did feel like, you know, I have this time limit where why bother doing anything because I'll be dead in a few years. So what's the point? And one of the things that really helped me was finding the teachings of Tosha Silver. She wrote this book called Outrageous Openness that I had read a few years earlier, but it kind of fell in my lap again. And she... Hold on a second. I took some notes here. She writes about letting go of attachment to outcome of things that my ego wants and really trusting in living in love and divine alignment so that I can bring so much more into my life than I ever could have imagined. And it's not religion per se. I'm not a religious person, but it's just the letting go of spiritual surrender and realizing that there's so much in my life right now that I have zero control over. You know, I can't make this disease go away. I can't change the things that have happened, the doctors that have wronged me, et cetera, et cetera. But there are things that are in my control and that, you know, I could be the best person that I can be with the things I have control over. And so I started having a much better attitude about the oxygen and realizing, well, if I'm going to have to carry this with me, I'm going to make fun of it. I'm going to, you know, one of my girlfriends called, I have a very large oxygen concentrator, my portable one, that looks like carry-on luggage. And she calls it R2 breathe to, just joking about it. But it really, you know, I haven't let it help keep me from doing things. And my doctors wanted me to go on disability and quit my job. And I, because they're looking at a piece of paper that tells them, you know, they just keep telling me how bad I am. And I said, look up from the paper and look at me and what I can accomplish. You know, I live alone, so I have to do everything myself. I don't have help to do things. I work full time. I take a bus to work. I've traveled cross country by plane several times to visit family. I do what I have to do and I try not to let it stop me. I mean, of course I do have to slow down occasionally and I do take care of my health and my, I do have some limitations, but I try not to let it get in my way as much as I can.
And I think what you talked about with that, you know, coming across Tosha's book, I hear this so often in the people that I talk to, that either there's a moment of turning away from either the faith or the church or the religion that they have in that moment where the chronic illness comes into their life or the disease comes into their life, and that feeling like of abandonment and, you know, well, what's the point? And even trying in that despair. And that many people can find a transformation in their faith and almost... a renewed spiritual experience, and there's so many rich blessings in that. I know that was certainly the case for me. You know, I got so many insights and so many profound moments in the worst times of the illness. It was almost like I was given these little periods of or gifts of grace that helped me get through that. And it sounds like when you came across the work of Tosha, it was one of those like spiritual gifts to say, here, look at this. Go with this and this will help you.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, if one really good outcome is it helped me start speaking my mind. I, you know, if you have nothing to lose and a limited time here, then why am I dealing with people that I shouldn't have in my life? So I just started cutting things out that didn't serve me and just you know, saying no to things I didn't want to do and just really taking care of me for the first time in my life.
And was there a point?
That was a huge gift.
Oh, yeah. That's all right. You were saying that that was a huge gift. And having that, I mean, with the doctors being so negative and, as you say, not even wanting to look up and look at you, just look at the papers and see how bad you were going and all of their talk of doom and gloom and that, I mean, when was the point where you thought, I'm going to have hope? Like, when did that hope for the best possible life for however long I live, when did that start to shift and you thought, I'm not just going to try and stay alive, I'm going to actually try and improve my health and my condition and see how far I can take this?
Well, I think around the same time that I was dealing with Tosha's work, and she has an online community forum that I'm a member of, so we support each other with these things. But I also started being drawn to books on near-death experience. And there was one in particular from Anita Morjani, who I've seen speak in a workshop. And it just started making me think about these people that have these stories about coming back and realizing that their purpose was to live in a place of love and joy and not to be focusing on all those negative things. And so it just, and I tended to be a negative person in general. I'm a native New Yorker. We tend to complain about everything and be, you know, negative when we need to. And it was a bit of a shift to get out of that mindset. And then there was another woman I stumbled across online. She calls herself the Cancer Warrioress. Tara Coyote is her name. And she is trying to heal herself of cancer naturally. And she had, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said something about how everyone talks about fighting their illness. And she said, rather than fighting it, to strive towards health instead and towards wellness. And so that was a huge shift for me of not looking at it as I'm going to fight for my life, as I'm going to stop grasping for things I have no control over and just be the best version of me I can.
And I love that. And I did a very similar thing when I first got ill, and I was so ill and so disabled. And I read everything I could get my hands on about near-death experiences, and I read Anita's book, and I just wanted something basically to comfort me, to help me just to come to terms with the fact that this could actually kill me, and try and sort of make some peace. But as you say, I think all of the things they're saying, well, why wait until you die to have that purpose? Like, why not try and do the things that they're talking about, which is come back and live a life of love and try and be as happy as you can be and try and be a force of good for the world? And why not do that now in whatever time that you've got? And that certainly helped me to start turning around the way that I viewed the illness that I live with as well.
Mm-hmm. I found that some of the support groups online that were related to the different conditions that I have, that I no longer felt comfortable in them because there was so much fear and so much negativity, and understandably so. It's a scary situation that people are in. But I found that my positivity was not always received very well. They thought I was either kidding myself or not fully understanding how serious my situation was. And they didn't want to hear someone being a cheerleader for love and light. They wanted someone to sit in that place of misery with them. And I honor that and respect that as their journey, but I knew that that was not helping me. I had started a blog where I was starting to write about my experiences, and I stopped it abruptly at some point because I realized all I'm doing is rehashing all this negative stuff about my illness, and I didn't want to go there anymore. I didn't want to put that energy with.
And so it sounds like it was that decision for you, Sue, to make that conscious choice to live now and do what you can do now and make the most of what you've got.
And I know the work that you and I did together also was so incredibly helpful in dealing with my with the trauma I had been through, my fear of dying, my anger at the doctors and life and everything. So I'm very grateful for that, because that was a huge part of my healing as well.
Thank you for that. It was really great to be able to work with you in that capacity. And because I think also it helps me understand so much more about the limitations of what other people say and how they try and predict, you know. And as you and I have talked about many times, your doctors don't know absolutely. They're working from a body of knowledge based on research and experience, but it's just a theory. And theory and research and evidence is changing all the time. And nobody knows for certain what's going to happen to any of us. And it's really a label, isn't it? When you think about it in that extent, they're just saying, here's a label with a prediction. But with that label and prediction are so many different ways that things can play out. And I think it's really important not to buy into those labels and say, well, they've said it, so that's what's going to happen. And I mean, you've really broken the mold with that, which is what I admire about you so much. In the face of all of that negativity, you've just said, no, I'm going to see how I can be and how I'm going to live and what I can do for myself. And then there was that point where it went from that spiral into, well, I'm just going to eat myself to death and have my, you know, my really black humor about what's going on, to actually, yeah, I'm going to give my body what it needs and what I feel it deserves and see what it's going to do with it. So tell people about that experience.
I'm sorry, I had a phone malfunction for a minute.
Yeah.
Forgive me, can you repeat the last part of what you just said?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was saying, at some point you made that decision to say, well, I'm actually going to start taking really great care of myself and great care of my body and see what that can do. So can you share with everybody listening why you decided to do that and what the steps were that you took to make that happen?
Well, I think the why was that being upset and self-destructive about it wasn't really serving me very well. And it was really only making me feel worse and not solving anything. So I didn't feel like that was a really great way to continue. Now I have my moments, you know, I'm not always positive and happy, but I think I had some practitioner once tell me that when you're feeling that way, to put a container around it. So say, well, yes, I'm going to have a fit or cry or be angry for 10 minutes, half an hour, whatever it takes. And then I'm going to get on with my day. Like, honor that it's okay to have those reactions, but not to stay in that place. But in terms of what I did, one of the biggest changes that I made was discovering and starting to actually follow the AIP, the autoimmune protocol diet, which I actually discovered by accident. I don't think I told you this story. I was looking for pictures of a phoenix to get a tattoo. And one of the samples on Google happened to be the Phoenix Helix website, which is Eileen Laird's website about autoimmune disease. And it looked interesting, but it was way too hard and I wasn't going to have any of that. So I bookmarked it, but I kept finding myself coming back to it. And I was listening to every podcast I could find on autoimmune disease. And one of her very early podcasts, someone was telling a story and she had sarcoidosis. And I have never heard those words outside of a doctor's office before. And here was someone that said that she, I believe she was mostly in remission from her sarcoidosis from doing the AIP diet. So I figured, what did I have to lose? And so things just kind of fell into place. I had joined the SAD to AIP in 6 weeks, the Standard American Diet to the AIP. It just happened to be starting up within the next month. So I had joined that, and over a 6 week period, we did all the food eliminations to get down to the elimination phase. And it's not always been easy. I'm cooking almost 100% of my food, like I have never done before. And I've been following it for 6 months now. And during that time, you know, I've lost 35 pounds, which I wasn't even trying to lose. My inflammation markers have been cut more than half of what they were. And I was able to lower my oxygen flow rate during activity, which was the biggest exciting news to me, to drop that by 20%. And so the less inflammation and pain has created the ability to be more active. And I'm training my lungs to have more stamina and work more efficiently. So while people think I'm living this life of misery with eating only whole foods and eating such a restrictive diet, it's actually bringing me so much more of a full life than I had 6 months ago. So it's worth every bit of effort that I've been putting into it.
Oh yeah. And that is so fantastic. I love that story about how you found it, how you found Eileen with the Phoenix. And, you know, the more I talk to people, the more I hear these seemingly random things that led them to something. And I had the same experience. I was lucky enough to talk to Terry Walls the other day and do a podcast with her. And I had been getting sucked into the internet with all the negativity, as we've talked about before, that a lot of the groups can ultimately become self-defeating because so many people, as you said, they're scared and they're in that dark place, and which is their right to be there. But if you're already frightened, it's not a good place to be. And I was selectively looking for positive things. I just was put into the search engine like, you know, recovery, autoimmune, positive or something like that. And it came up with Terry Walls' Minding Your Mitochondria TED Talk. And I watched that. And that gave me hope. It was like this woman got herself out of a tilt reclining wheelchair with multiple sclerosis to riding her bike again. And I was by changing her diet. And I was like, that gives me something I can do. And that was all I needed. I just needed something, some way, something that I could do to help myself. And I don't believe there's any accidents in the world. I believe
everything was falling into place with me. All these things that just kept popping up. And you're right. I don't believe that there were coincidences. I think I was finally in a place to hear these messages. Mm. Where sometimes I would say to myself, well, I wish I'd made some of these changes, you know, a year ago, 5 years ago, and maybe things would have been different, but I probably wouldn't have done it then. Mm. You know, I mean, like, because I wouldn't have had that urgency to do it. Like, people ask me what keeps me going on AIP, and I said, well, initially, fear. Because if I don't get the inflammation down in my lungs, I am going to die. I mean, that's fact, because it's taking the growths in my lungs, they said, look like ground glass, and they're taking up all the space in my lungs. So without changing that, there's not a very good outcome. So if there's something I can do, why not? I mean, what's the worst that happened? It does nothing. Hmm. And it's shown that right now it's absolutely not doing nothing. It's helping me very much. Hmm. And I'm very happy. Hmm. You know, that's one thing I wouldn't have thought even a year ago that I would ever say that I'm happy. So that's a good place to be.
Hmm. Oh, for sure. And one of the things that I most love about you, Sue, is that you make up your mind to do something and you do it. I mean, there must have been so much naysaying from the doctors about you can't get on an aeroplane and fly across the country because this might happen and this might happen and this might happen. I mean, how did you decide that that wasn't going to stop you? Because they must have been throwing so many fearful scenarios at you about the possible things that could happen if you travel. What gave you the courage to just think, I'm just going to do it anyway?
I guess I'm just stubborn. If someone tells me I can't do something, I'm going to prove them otherwise. I've always been like that. But I'm very quick to fire doctors that don't serve me. And these doctors that I have right now, they're actually very lovely people, and they're doing the best that they can. But I think the reality is most people who are, quote unquote, as sick as me, really have rolled over and are waiting to die, and they're not making these changes in their life. And so they're not going to be in as good a condition to continue and to have the energy to do this. I'm very grateful that right now I am. I don't know how long that will continue for, but until I'm unable to, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing.
And it sounds like in many ways, like at the moment, your health is actually better than it's ever been.
Right now, yes. I'm going in a few months for another pulmonary function test, which is where they measure the input and output of your lungs, and that's how they stage what percentage of lung capacity you have. And when I had started out, I was at about 56% of lung function, which I thought was really bad until I started realizing that there were people with 10 and 15% on lung transplant lists. But through the first 6 months of after diagnosis, I actually got up to almost 60%. So it actually already had improved on some of the early changes. It's not a pleasant test to go through, but I'm actually looking forward to it this time around because I want to see if there are changes. But I also have to remind myself that it's just a number and a snapshot in time. And so if they suddenly tell me I've decreased, that doesn't mean the worst is coming and that I've failed. It's just data. And that's what I have to remind myself.
Exactly.
But it is helpful to get those little snapshots to see where I am at a given time.
And that's exactly the attitude that I take, because I do have regular blood tests just to measure the volume of thyroid hormones in my bloodstream, and then change my diagnosis, my dosage of natural desiccated thyroid accordingly. And it started out that it was, as I got better, I needed less because my liver was working a lot better and it healed, and all the systems of my body were working better. My gut was healing, which meant it was converting the T4 better to the T3. So I was able to actually almost drop my dosage by over a third. And then I thought, oh, this is great, this is great, this is great. Your numbers are going down. And then there came a point where I actually needed to go up again. And I really had to go through a process in my mind to not see that as a failure or not get scared, like, what am I doing wrong? Is it not working anymore? Is this going to be the downhill slide? And so what you're talking about doing is that constant mind management, isn't it? It's that being aware of your thoughts and being aware of the beliefs that are going with them, and talking to yourself and reassuring yourself in a way that keeps you able to manage that with the best possible attitude that you can have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because I had that also where I needed to increase my thyroid medication, and I had the same reaction that you spoke of where you start wondering, oh no, what has happened? But I have two different naturopaths who were reviewing my blood work, and one of them said that the changes in this blood work actually showed that my body is processing my food differently and that everything I'm doing is more efficient in my body right now since the 6 months of doing the AIP. And that would explain why things are changing with thyroid, because my body is different than it was 6 months ago.
And I guess it's going into that unknown country, isn't it? Because I know when I first started making my interventions and changing my diet and going on to NDT, that both my doctor and my naturopath were completely unanimous. And they said, Kerry, realistically, you're looking at least 2 years to start to see a good recovery, like at least 2 years. And they were pretty spot on. Maybe a couple of months under before there really was that difference from not being able to function to being able to function. And in my own experience, I've seen every year I do a little review sort of where I am. And every year there's new gains. And that continues to excite me because I'm 4 years into doing this now. And it's only this year I have fully got back my ability to read books for pleasure. Like, and I used to be a huge bookworm. But even as my reading started to come back, I did not have the desire to read because it still felt like work. You know, I still had to focus and deliberately pay attention. But it's only now that I can read like I used to, which is just pick up a book, fall into the book, and just enjoy it without having to consciously focus or keep my mind on the words as I'm reading the words and being able to take it all in. And that's huge. So, I mean, I'm really excited for you. This is 6 months for you and you're already seeing those fantastic changes.
Mm-hmm. And I know so many people focus on the food with AIP, but one of the things that I really liked about it is its lifestyle as well, where, as you know, working with whether we're getting enough sleep and enough nutrient density and enough rest and connection to people and nature. And these are things that, you know, I put on the back burner. Like, if I have too many things to do, then sleep wasn't as necessary. And I knew it was, but it was easy to stay up way too late and be functioning on 5 hours of sleep. And so making those changes as well, which sometimes, frankly, are harder than the food to make those lifestyle changes, but they really made so much more of a difference in how I felt. You know, you don't realize how awful you feel from not getting enough sleep until you start consistently going to bed around the same time and getting enough sleep. I mean, it sounds so matter of fact, but, you know, it was an interesting lesson I've been learning.
And there's all those little different things, and you're absolutely right. It's not just about the food you're eating. It's also the attitude towards the food that you're eating as well. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things for me to get over was the whole fear of eating out, because of mm-hmm. the possibility of, so I have celiac disease as well, of cross contamination, and, you know, knowing that if I experienced getting gluten, that would literally put me back in bed, and I didn't want to be back in bed and feeling the way that I felt. And because I know that, you know, the time it takes to get over being gluten is can be weeks and maybe even months instead of days. So I just wouldn't eat out at all. And if I did eat out, I would be so anxious. Like, as I'm eating, I'm almost monitoring myself, waiting for the reaction. And so what I've been working on this past year has just been just make the best choice that you can, like make it clear what all of your issues are, get something that feels as safe as it can, and then enjoy it. Like, just relax and enjoy it and trust yourself. And if something happens, you'll deal with it. If you have a reaction, you'll deal with it. And so that's, you know, something that I'm still working on managing, because there's so much fear when you get a chronic illness, because you're aware, as you said before, you know, your life was there and you think you've got decades ahead of you and you're going to do all of those things. And when that's suddenly taken away from you and everything's uncertain, you sort of want to grip on tightly to everything you've got to maintain that control. And that's what you were saying before, that's so important, that you've got to realize how many things are outside of your control and just work with and enjoy the things that you can control and influence in your life.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things when I started working with Tosha Silver's work was, you know, I used to, we often refer to it as offering up our troubles, like to, you know, send them up to the universe and expect that divine outcome will, you know, the best possible outcome will prevail. But I was always praying for healing and health, you know, I mean, which makes sense. We all want to be healthy and I want these problems to go away. And that's very hard to offer up your health and your life to the unknown. But one day it hit me and I said, here I am praying and asking for health, but what if that is simply not an option for me? What if I'm never going to heal and in fact will get worse and I will die from this? Am I still okay offering this? And that's a really tough question, you know, because, you know, who wants to to accept that there is nothing, there really is nothing that can be done. You know, so that I had a lot of work to do around that as well. And I think I've, living in the moment has helped me a lot, because even if I were 100% healthy, or at least what we perceive as 100% healthy, none of us know if, you know, I mean, it sounds very cliche, but you get hit by a bus tomorrow. No one knows what the next path is for any of us. And so I try not to worry about those small things, because I really don't have any control over it.
Mm. And I think what you were dealing with, and probably the experience that other people who in situations similar to yours, is there are so many words like that have a huge emotional psychological impact just by hearing them. And that's things like cancer and things like terminal. And when you get something like that, it literally goes into your subconscious mind and it just sets off all of these, you know, explosions, because we've got all of this negative associations of that, because, you know, people who get cancer die, and terminal means you're going to die. And so it just, that suggestion just goes in and it sticks with you. And I mean, from your experience, what would you advise or suggest to people who are facing like a terminal diagnosis, or a diagnosis where they're being given very little hope at all, to help themselves just deal with that?
Well, around the time that I was dealing with this in the beginning, I was taking this class at my Unitarian church about the Buddhist. It was a Buddhist book about living and dying. And one of the things in, and I can't remember the book, but we were talking about terminal, the word terminal. And I realized that simply all that means, if you have a terminal illness, it means there is no cure. So frankly, life is terminal. We're all going to die. So that made it feel a little bit less scary. Terminal didn't necessarily mean imminent death. It just meant there is no known cure right now for that issue. And somebody else in the group had said to me that when they hear the word terminal, they think of like a bus terminal where they're changing directions, you know, getting off one mode of transportation onto another. And that really stuck with me, because that really is what happened. It's like, here I was on my nice, smooth express train to a long, happy life. And then it's like, nope, get dumped off, you know, and go on to the local train that's stopping and all these other issues. And so it was a very different way of looking at it. Mm. You know, the other thing that I started thinking about was how, you know, we all focus on, like, everybody keeps telling me how quote unquote bad my lungs are. And they show me pictures and scans of what they look like. And I decided one day to Google what healthy lungs actually look like. I really had no idea what the inside of a pair of lungs. And I started to visualize that's what my lungs looked like. They were pink and soft and smooth and everything was great. Because I realized that, you know, I've heard things about how every cell in our body regenerates in X number of years. So why is it then that these damaged cells in my lungs can't regenerate? I mean, they tell me, the great they tell me that it can't be done, but why not? You know, I mean, I think a lot of it is because we continue to do the damage that caused something in the first place. So if I'm making changes and trying to shift my entire life, why can't I get somewhat better, if not entirely so? Mm. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Mm. And I love that, because that visualization is such a powerful thing, and then your subconscious mind starts to buy into that, and, you know, all the cells in the body have an intelligence and they're all listening to what we say constantly all the time. So as you say, like, who knows? Like, why not? Why not? There is no one who can say those things can't happen. I mean, it's in the medical literature that's called spontaneous remission, where people have had something like cancer and within a time period, it's completely gone from their body and can no longer be seen or found in tests. So they know that that happens, and it's still a medical mystery. And it is possible But I think one of the issues is that people are frightened of giving false hope. And I think that's what happens with the doctors when they're seeing something that, according to their research and their experiences, has always resulted in a certain result, which is death through this process, that they don't want to, they want to try and prepare you for the worst, and they don't want to give you what they think is false hope that things can get better. And I think that, and the whole thing of, you know, being sued for not giving you the correct information does really stop them from trying to give you any hope at all. And I guess they'd probably say they're being realistic. And I think you and I both know that realistic is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? It's whatever you're living.
You know, it's a balancing act of listening to what they have to say and taking in the data and then discarding what part of it I don't feel like dealing with and then doing what I want to do. Exactly. Like if I happen to get down to that magic weight that allows me to go see the transplant doctors, even though I currently don't have any plans of doing that, I'll go see them because I think knowledge is power. And I think it's helpful to understand what their thoughts are, what the process would be, and then I can make a more informed decision, but I'm not losing any sleep over that path right now.
And Sue, out of all of the things that you've done, you know, and I know you've done a lot, so many different things, what are you most proud of in this journey of your health?
That's a good question. I think I'm most proud of the fact that after almost 56 years on this earth, I'm finally starting to really love myself and make myself a priority rather than taking care of everyone else. I think that's, you know, and that I can still laugh throughout everything I've been through. I can still laugh and find joy in the world. And I think that is so cliched sounding, but it's true.
And why would you tell people that if they can work on that self-love bit? I mean, what's the transformation of that? Why would that be a worthwhile goal for them to pursue?
Well, I think, you know, in this society, we're not taught to love ourselves. We're taught to love everybody else and take care of everybody else. And I think it's really vital to being our best selves. And I don't think we can truly love anyone else until we love ourselves. And to accept that we are worthy of being loved by ourselves and others. So I think it's a huge piece of it for me.
And I think the biggest thing to that too is you love yourself as you are. And that includes love yourself with the illness, you know, not love yourself when you get healthy or love yourself when you lose the weight. It's that unconditional, wherever I am right now, however I'm feeling right now, I'm willing to love myself the way that I am without any of those conditions and just offer yourself that grace, which is, I think that's really anti-inflammatory, just being able to do that because it literally takes a weight off you, doesn't it? When you can just be with yourself and accept yourself and love yourself, and it makes everything so much easier.
I agree. I know I have a lot of people ask me why I don't take my oxygen cannula off for photographs. And I said, why should I? Because it's who I am right now. I mean, I'm not the oxygen, but it's part of my existence. So why am I going to hide from that?
Exactly. And like I said,
even that photo that you're using for this came from a photo shoot that I did with a photographer doing, where we played with the oxygen. I was using it as a jump rope at some point and just having fun with it and, you know, making friends with it, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is a huge difference over the past 18 months from where I started with it.
Oh, yeah.
Where it felt more like a noose than a toy or a friend.
Yes. And that's that transformation that I was talking about where, you know, you have just made it, because you're so matter of fact and accepting of it and you're unapologetic for it. And why should you need to apologize? It's what you need, and you know, it's just a little thing that sits on your face, and so what? You know, so what? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the whole thing, isn't it? The more accepting we can be of where we are and what we've got, and the more matter of fact we are about it, the more likely other people are to be okay with it, because they really pick up the cue from us, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I have a lot of children asking me questions about it. And, you know, the parents have that horrified look of don't ask the lady about her illness. And, you know, I'm happy to explain to people, you know. I think the hardest part with that is that most people assume that I'm on oxygen because I damaged my lungs by smoking. And I've never smoked, so that absolutely wasn't what happened. And even if I did, I don't think it's right to shame people for the fact that they did. And I see that even at the doctor's office, whenever I get printouts of stuff after my lung test, it says, if you're still smoking, you must stop. So they, even there, that's their assumption that, you know, you did this to yourself.
Mm.
So there's nobody to blame other than you.
Mm. Yeah, which is it's just not fair, and it's not helpful to do that to anybody. And I think that's something that we've all got to resist in ourselves, because I know a lot of people get caught up on if they could just work out what it was that they did, you know, what did they do to deserve this, or what did they did wrong, or if they'd only done this, or if they'd only been that, or if they'd only have stopped, you know, eating that particular thing, that they wouldn't be where they are. But you are where you are, and there's no changing it. It's just do the best that you can with where you are. And I think you are, you know, such a powerful, positive living example of that, of just being the best that you can exactly where you are and making the most of your life and refusing to let that stop you.
Thank you. I'm hoping that, you know, anyone listening that's in a similar situation with their illness, whatever that illness may be, can, that it can help somebody to not feel as despaired all the time about the situation.
Mm. No, I'm sure that everything you've said today is going to be exactly what somebody's been waiting to hear. So thank you again so much, Sue. It's been such a delight getting to share you with the people who listen to the podcast. I know you're going to help people, and you know, we're always going to stay in touch, and I'm very interested to see how you're doing. So thank you so much once again.
It's been a pleasure.
And everybody, I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another podcast. And thanks for listening, and see you then. Bye.
You have been listening to the Emotional Autoimmunity Podcast. You can read the show notes over at my website, www.emotionalautoimmunity.com, and sign up to get your free copy of Moving Through the Grief of Chronic Illness, a 9-phase model from anxiety to resilience. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and if you enjoyed this episode, I would love you to leave a review. Thanks for listening.